Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater, a State House reporter for the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Aaliyah Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk to Delegate Vanessa Atterbury, a Democrat representing Maryland's 13th District in Howard County. She is the vice chair of the very important House Judiciary Committee that deals with all the criminal justice and law enforcement issues that come through this session.
But first, we're going to take a look back at the Baltimore Sun reporting from this past week. If you can believe it, we're now over a third of the way done with legislative session.
Yay!
And things took a pretty significant turn this week from a bipartisan love fest that was the start of the session to a little bit more contentious sort of partisan bickering. So it's the dead of winter. Why are elected officials so heated over summer?
Yes, the Democrats who control a majority of the General Assembly are attempting to override Republican Governor Larry Hogan's 2016 executive order that public schools may not start until after Labor Day. And people are getting a little bit angry about this. To discuss, I'm going to bring in Pamela Wood from the Sun's State House Bureau. Pamela and I have been taking turns sitting in on these marathon debate sessions in the Senate. Hey, Pam. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we've been talking about the hot issue of the past week and still continuing into this week, which is Labor Day and when to start it. Can you briefly sum up both sides here? What do the Democrats argue? What do the Republicans argue?
Sure. And this is not going away anytime soon. So this goes back several years. For forever, local school boards have been able to set the start date and end date for the school calendar. And once upon a time, it was always after Labor Day. Over the years, it creeped back up to before Labor Day. When I was in school in Howard County, we were before Labor Day. And so there was this push driven by Comptroller Peter Francho, Ocean City lawmakers and merchants to put school after Labor Day. And it was talked about for a while, and finally, Governor Hogan in 2016 signed an executive order mandating that schools must start after Labor Day and they must end by June 15th. And it's highly popular. It was about 70% popularity at the time. But since then, school systems have had to wrestle with the calendars, and there's been no public polling since, but some people have raised some opposition to it, that it's difficult to get in all of the religious holidays, the teacher work days, the secular holidays, all into that time frame and still get your 180 days of instruction. So this year there's a bill that is making its way through the General Assembly that would return the school calendar decision-making authority back to the local school boards.
And the rhetoric of this debate has really escalated.
I can't imagine where this kind of idiocy comes from. I mean, you.
Governor Hogan called the Democrats idiots and said their idea was stupid.
And there is a 100% chance that this will be overturned by the public with a referendum that will pass by 70 or 80%. And they will all say, if they're ever reelected, I'm really sorry I did that stupid thing. Any other questions on that topic?
Senator Joanne Benson from Prince George's County said the Republicans were behaving in foolishness.
Mr. Chairman, could you please tell me why we are continuing this conversation? Huh? Why are we having it? The conversation should end. If these people who are getting up talking want to have schools opening after Labor Day, do it. Well, let's not continue with this foolishness here today. Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
That is out of line. It's not foolishness. We have issues, and we're addressing it.
The Republicans tried to amend the bill to include a Harriet Tubman Day, and that forced the Democrats to vote against Harriet Tubman. It was getting a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, they were. The Democrats were not thrilled with the Republicans over that maneuver, because, like, who would want to vote against Harriet Tubman?
Look, ladies and gentlemen of the Senate, this amendment is a diversion. It's a diversion of someone who many of us respect Harry Tubman, Frederick Douglass. I'm reading his biography now. I know the Senate president has it on his desk. There are a number of African-American leaders and other dynamic leaders of our state. That's not what this bill addresses. And if the maker of the motion wants to take this to the Baltimore County Board of Education, I'll stand right next to you. And if we want to have a march on behalf of Harry Tubman and Frederick Douglass and all the other leaders, I'm with you. But this, I'm not going to disparage it, but I think it's a diversion. Let me just put it at that.
And as this is all playing out, the bill moving through the Senate, Governor Hogan called a press conference and went on and on about his opposition, how terrible this is. He must have gone for about 10 minutes about how what a bad idea this is, how it's subverting the will of the people. And then he offered his, I call it a counterproposal. He calls it a compromise. But last I understood, a compromise had to have both parties engaged, and that's not happening here at all. But his proposal is, one, if the bill passes both chambers, that there should be a referendum effort to put it on the ballot. And secondly, he said he is drafting his own bill, which we have not seen yet. But his bill would say, okay, if you want to start before Labor Day, local school board, you have to put that on the ballot for your county's or city's voters to approve it. Because he believes he is following the will of the people and that he represents that more than the local school boards do. He's called them unelected, you know, bureaucrats who aren't accountable, which is actually incorrect in many respects. We now have elected school boards, but that's the battle that's shaping up in Annapolis.
And the most heated exchange came between Senator Paul Pinsky, a Prince George's County Democrat, who is the bill's lead sponsor, and Senator Bob Cassilly, a Harford County Republican. What happened there?
Yeah, so Senator Pinsky is the sponsor of the bill. He's also the floor leader, which means he's the person leading debate for those in favor of the bill on the full Senate floor. So last week he was making an argument that one person shouldn't decide something that affects all public school children, millions, in the state of Maryland.
No one individual, ladies and gentlemen, no one individual, even if they're armed with an executive order, should have the right to stand on the schoolhouse steps and say, students, you can't enter here before Labor Day. No one individual should be able to stand on the schoolhouse steps if they're armed with an executive order, scribbled with a signature, and say, June 15th, you got to get out of the school. The issue is about self-determination.
He said that, and the debate moved on. A couple people later, Senator Bob Cassilly, a Republican from Harford County, got up and said he was highly offended.
Colleagues, I usually rise in a spirit of comedy, but I rise in utter outrage. A lot of us my age were children when we watched a certain governor stand on the steps of the school and deny little black boys and little black girls the right to go in and get an education. And colleagues, that is exactly what the chairman was, the picture he was painting was to suggest that Governor Hogan's statement on this issue was akin to a governor standing on the floor as a bigot and denying young black children an education. I think it's utterly outrageous, and I think that he ought to apologize to this body and to the governor. I find no humor, and there's no defense for that.
Now, when that happened, nobody reacted. Senator Pinsky didn't say anything. Nobody else said anything. The debate just went on to the next person who raised a completely different point, and kind of that was it. But when asked about it later, you know, the governor's office said, look, we need to have, you know, bipartisanship and, you know, a disagreement without being disagreeable, and the senator should pay attention to that. So they didn't quite call for an apology, but they were none too pleased with Senator Pinsky's comments.
And you called him and asked him about it. What did he have to say?
Right. He didn't back down from his comments. He said, look, he was thinking about civil rights in particular after that Harriet Tubman dust up the day before, and he really does see this as the governor keeping children out of school when the school districts want the kids in class. So, you know, he made no apologies, and kind of that was it.
Pamela Wood from the Sun State House Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Isn't it going to be great in 2 years when we can stream that debate live? Okay, it's been a while since we've asked about this issue in the Goucher poll. But Hogan's right, or at least he was right. Around 70% or a majority of Marylanders did support the post-Labor Day start. He's actually citing a Goucher poll from both before and after he issued that executive order.
Now, there's been some criticism over this particular poll question. Back in 2015, Senator Paul Pinsky, who you heard from in that clip, wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun criticizing how the question was asked. He argued it had no explanation of trade-offs, like extending the school year later into June, removing existing holiday breaks, or more importantly, shortening the school year. He likened it to asking voters, do you like mom and apple pie? Malia, you're the pollster in question here. How do you respond?
So this line of criticism brings up some interesting questions about polling on policy issues. So when you do horse race polling, everybody is critical of your likely voter model. They complain that there aren't enough Democrats, not enough Republicans, that you're underestimating or overestimating turnout by any given demographic, just stuff like that. When you do policy issue polling, everybody complains about the question wording. My perspective has always been that pollsters should define but not explain the issue at hand to the public. We want to make sure that all respondents are thinking about the same issue, that the question, quote unquote, means the same thing to Bob as it does to Sue when asked. But our job is to gauge public sentiment. It's the advocate's job to move it in the direction in which they want. And it's not that I'm opposed to questions that includes trade-offs either. In fact, I actually remember considering saying, opponents say that the school calendar should be left up to school districts, but supporters argue that that a post-Labor Day start will boost the Maryland economy as part of the question. But my main goal is to reduce bias and get a clear snapshot of what people think about the issue. So I ultimately decided against including either one of those prompts and just went with the issue without the arguments. This is how we actually asked it in 2016. Next, as you may have heard, an executive order moved the official start date of Maryland public schools to after Labor Day weekend beginning next year. Do you support or oppose this executive order? Now, I could have asked the question like this. Do you think that local school boards or the state government should determine the public school calendar? But there's a problem with this question wording, too. The executive order doesn't give full state control over school calendars. It just mandates that the calendar starts post-Labor Day. So I guess what I'm saying is no single poll question is the definitive word on where the public stands on any particular policy. But the polling does suggest that the public is probably not as upset about the executive order as some Democrats in the General Assembly were this week.
Yeah, it was getting a little ugly.
It did. And when the issue was first being discussed back in 2015 and 16, I used to sort of cringe when I would hear legislators say things like, we shouldn't jeopardize our students' education to sell more Thrasher's fries on our boardwalk. And I always thought this was a little bit dismissive of people's livelihoods that do depend on the tourism industry, and not to say that education isn't really, really important in the state. So it's important, I think, to be sensitive to the low-income families that live here in Baltimore City that might be disproportionately affected by that sort of that one extra week of summer, but also for those individuals who work in sort of a lower to middle-class jobs on the Eastern Shore that might get a little boost from perhaps a post-Labor Day start. I'm interested, really, into finally getting the report to see how much a post-Labor Day start did actually help the Eastern Shore economy.
Absolutely. And we expect this debate to continue this week, now that the legislation will be moving from the Senate into the House. We have every indication it has the support of both chambers and will move eventually to Governor Hogan's desk, where I'm sure he will veto it. But I wanted to change topics very briefly. For our next segment, I wanted to bring in Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green. I always get a lot of questions and comments at the State House whenever Andy and his team write an editorial. And I always say that I have nothing to do with that. So I thought it'd be great to bring him on to discuss the work of the opinion section. Hey, Andy, good morning.
Hi, Luke.
Just briefly, because people are coming up to me all the time in Annapolis and weighing in on opinions on different things that you guys have written. For the uninitiated, can you describe the difference between the Sun's news staff and the opinion staff?
Yeah. So the editorial page staff is a small group of people. We operate independently from the newsroom, so we don't suggest what news people should write, and news reporters like Luke, and they don't suggest what we should write either. We do that to help maintain the integrity of the news writing so that it's free of any any kind of bias that we might have. And meanwhile, we you know, try to also come to sort of independent judgments about things that are going on and not sort of limited to what has or hasn't been reported in the news pages. You know, our job is to try to provide some context to events that are going on, to present a point of view about them that's kind of consistent with where the sun has been historically, and, you know, in a lot of cases to offer our two cents about what public officials ought to do about the big issues of the day.
So speaking of that, we are one-third of the way through the General mm-hmm. Assembly session. What does the Sun's editorial board want to see accomplished? What issues are you tracking most closely?
Well, the most important thing, as far as we're concerned, is setting the stage for implementation of the Kerwin Commission reforms to Maryland's education system. Part of that has to do with money. Obviously, that's, I think, the big sticking point in Annapolis is figuring out how to pay for something that could theoretically increase the amount of money we're spending on education by, you know, nearly $4 billion within the next 10 years. But there are a lot of other policy pieces to this as well in terms of changing our expectations in high school, our standards for teacher quality, the way teachers are compensated, all kinds of different things that stem from a couple of years long effort by this group to see, you know, globally, not just in Maryland, not just in the United States, but all over the world, how do the best school systems work? What do they do that we're not doing? How do we stack up? The answer to that is not all that well. And what can we do to improve? And so there's a lot of work going on in the legislature in terms of folks trying to figure this out, where we go from here to start putting some kind of down payment on this year. But we've been pretty aggressive in trying to push Governor Hogan to become more directly involved in this. He's expressed some sort of general support for where Kerwin is going, but has balked at the price tag and has not really been in the lead in this in the way that Maryland governors we think ought to be. So we've been pretty hard on him about that, about trying to get him more directly involved. That's a big one. Another big one this year is the Clean Energy Jobs Act. You know, all the research we're seeing shows that the need to address climate change is really immediate, that we all need to start taking steps to avoid really catastrophic change to the climate. Maryland has done some noble and notable things over the years in terms of setting our standards for clean energy and air pollution, but this is really the next step to get us up within a reasonable time frame to 100% renewable clean energy. And we believe that if we act quickly and aggressively on this, then Maryland can become an economic leader in that transformation. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for manufacturing, for installation, all these sorts of things. And the sooner Maryland commits itself to this path, the more likely it is we'll be a center for that industry. And then I'd say the third major area we're watching is related to healthcare. It was a great session for healthcare last year in terms of Maryland establishing a reinsurance program that has helped reduce the rates on the Affordable Care Act exchange at a time when they otherwise would have gone up massively for the two remaining carriers on that exchange. But that hasn't completely solved the problem. I mean, first of all, the funding for the reinsurance program is going to run out in another couple of years, and after that, we have no idea what's going to happen. And another thing, the system is going to be facing pressures because of the end of the individual mandate on the federal level, that there's no longer any fee attached to that. So the concern here and nationwide is that fewer people are going to fewer young, healthy people specifically are going to be buying insurance on these exchanges, which drives up the prices for the people who remain there. So we're hoping that the legislature will pass a Maryland version of the individual mandate. There's a really terrific idea the healthcare advocates have been pushing that allows you to, instead of just paying a fee to the treasury of the state if you don't have insurance, instead to be able to use that fine as a down payment on buying insurance, which serves the purpose of getting more people in the system, more people covered, and we think that's a great way to go. Another big issue this year is reform in prescription drug prices. We've also been supportive of the idea of creating a state commissioner panel to review large increases in drug prices or the prices of really expensive new drugs. So we're hopeful to see that happen this year as well.
And then you guys weighed in this weekend on the handgun permit review board.
Yeah.
There was a piece in Maryland Matters about the annual statistics where, you know, this board very rarely agrees with the state police.
Yeah.
And there was an annual report. It only was one page of information. It didn't really provide a lot of details. But
yeah, we've been watching this for a few years now. You'll recall when Governor Hogan first ran for office, he said, look, I'm going to be hands off on gun-related issues. Last year, he even supported a couple of gun control measures. But something that people have been concerned about is whether his appointees to this handgun permit review board were going to take a much more permissive stance toward concealed carry permits than Maryland has traditionally had. Some states, if you apply for a concealed carry permit and you don't have any disqualifying things in your past, like a felony conviction or whatever, you just automatically get a concealed carry permit. But Maryland is not one of those states. We require you to have a good and substantial reason for why you need to be carrying a firearm, like some direct threats against you or some kind of occupational hazard, like, you know, you carry large amounts of cash to the bank or something like that. And so the state has traditionally been pretty strict in terms of who gets these, which we believe in the research suggests is true, that having fewer people with guns on the streets, legal or illegal, results in lower levels of violent crime, that it's simply just not safe to have lots of armed people on the streets. You know, even people who have the best of intentions, you know, bad things can happen, and they do in states that have more permissive laws. Anyway, so the nominees that Governor Hogan has put on this board over the years have been overturning Maryland State Police decisions on concealed carry permits or loosening restrictions that the state police provide on these permits at a really surprising rate. It's like, you know, if you go to this board and you actually show up for your hearing and you ask for a reversal of your denial or a modification of the restrictions on you, you're pretty much going to get it. And so last year, former Senator Rich Mattolino put in a bill calling for the abolition of this board and putting these appeals in the hands of administrative law judges, which we thought was a good idea because, A, they're going to be more well-versed in the law, and, B, it provides consistency from one administration to another, so you don't have a situation where the standard one day is different the next based on who's the governor. Unfortunately, that didn't pass last year, but now we have, you know, more statistics, as you said, showing this is a real pattern of this agency not being so much a review board as a reversal board. And so we're hopeful that it will get a little more momentum this year.
So you're not talking about doing away with appeal rights for concealed carry. It's just about
who
does the appeals.
Yeah.
Yes.
This would put it in the hands of administrative law judges who, as I said, you know, have long tenures. They can apply consistent standards over the years. And it's not just going to be a question of who the governor is and who he appoints and who he gets through the executive nominations committee.
Andy Green, the Sun's opinion page editor. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Today we're happy to have on our show Delegate Vanessa Atterbury. Welcome to the show, Delegate.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Okay. We're going to get back to the policy stuff in just a minute. You mentioned earlier that your district is the best district, and everybody always says that about your district. But what makes you think it's the best district, and why should somebody want to move to your district in Howard County?
District 13 is incredibly diverse. It's more diverse. When people think of Howard County, I don't know that they necessarily think of diversity. But I can tell you it's become more diverse since I was growing up. I was surprised. My oldest son, who is now in first grade, when we went to kindergarten, I walked into his kindergarten class. I mean, it looked like the little UN. I was literally like, oh, my gosh. I mean, it's just so great. And so, you know, I think that brings problems in terms of people who live there who aren't necessarily used to that diversity, and it certainly brings problems with the rhetoric that we hear, you know, from our president, and which flows all the way down. And so we've had some issues in Howard County, but I mean, for the most part, people thrive on our diversity. We thrive on our differences, and it's just a great place to be. We have a fantastic school system. I actually, as you probably know, had a little stunt in Montgomery County where I lived after law school because I didn't want to live in the suburbs. So I'm like, oh, I want to hang out and be close to D.C. But I moved back. I was like, I want my kids to be able to go to public school in Howard County, where I went, because we've got just a fantastic school system.
Okay, so we're going to move away from your district for a minute. And let's talk about the backbone of the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. African-American women. Mm-hmm. So black women by the numbers in elective office look like this in the United States today. Of the 100 members of the U.S. Senate, there is one black woman. Of the 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, there are 18 black women. Of the 74 women serving in statewide elected office, two are black. Of the 100 largest U.S. cities, five have a black female mayor. And of the 1,800 women serving nationwide as state legislators, 266, or 14%, are African American women. Okay. And so I was reading some research by the Brookings Institute and Higher Heights Leadership Fund. This is an organization dedicated to support black women's leadership pipeline. And they found that black women only comprise about 2% of all the candidates in 2016. Now, this number did bump up in 2018, but it's still low. Mm-hmm. And despite being virtually tied or sometimes besting white women in terms of voter registration and turnout, black women are just less likely to be encouraged and more likely to be discouraged to run for elected mm-hmm. office. And when black women run, they are less likely to receive the early dollars and endorsements that help candidates win successful campaigns. Mm-hmm. So take me through your legislative history. Is this your experience? And what do you think are ways to sort of improve this experience to increase the diversity in the Maryland state legislature and legislatures nationwide?
So, yes, that has been my experience. So I first ran in Montgomery County in District 18. And silly me, I thought, I'm very active in the community. I'm an attorney. I'm passionate about certain issues. I can run for office. And, you know, I got smacked down. We did very well. We got some endorsements. I didn't think we were going to get any, quite frankly. The few that we did get, I think that the folks who gave them to us were excited to see we got a lot of young people, a lot of Latinos involved in the campaign. But what was interesting is a lot of people in the establishment, particularly in the establishment of my party, came to me and said, you know, you would be great, but not right now. Right now is not your turn. Why don't you run for school board? Or why don't you, you know, get on the central committee? And I thought, that's not what I want to do. And so when I moved back to Howard County, hatched a plan, moved back, and an opportunity came, and I decided to run. This time was different because there were three non-incumbents running, and we all interviewed to run with the incumbents on District 13, which was Senator Gazzoni, Delegate Shane Pendergrass, and Delegate Turner. And lucky for me, they picked me. That doesn't mean that everybody who had been very active in the county, and particularly in District 13, supported me, because they didn't. I still had to knock on a lot of doors, you know, go to all the things that you do, you know, the forums and all of that. But I had the backing of my team, which helped. You know, was a large financial contribution I had to agree that whether you write a check or you're going to raise it, that's what I'm committed to doing. And it's not a small sum of money. And so, you know, even with the backing, I wasn't getting all the donations necessarily. The big ones that I did get at the time, Delegate Pendergrass and Senator Guy Gazzoni or Frank, you know, had called someone and said, given us some money. So it's hard. And, you know, when you've got a family to take care of, whether it's children or aging parents or whomever, you know, more things change, the more they stay the same. And we as women are the caretakers. And I was just raised to believe that I could do anything I want, regardless of what anybody says. So, you know, I don't think we necessarily encourage African-American women to run. We do encourage, and there's a mechanism in the state that is encouraging women to run, but I don't know that there's really a focus on African-American women to run for office.
Is that something you would perhaps be interested in doing?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite things to do being elected is I go to talk to high school folks. I talk to kids that are in college, particularly women, and I let them come shadow me however I can help. put them on a path, particularly if they're really interested in running for office, I'm happy to do that.
Wonderful. So I'm actually a big believer in the virtue of descriptive representation. And for little girls to be it, little girls must see it. Mm-hmm. And I think that means something specific for black girls to see black women run in public office. And so you alluded to this, but what big things in Maryland do you think have to change to increase the levels of women's representation, particularly among African-American women?
Well, we got to change campaign contributions and how we handle that, and campaign finance. That's a huge thing, because it's just very difficult to raise money, particularly when you're all going to the same pool of people because you all have the same circles. So that's one thing that we have to change. And we have to change folks willing to just be mentors and show people and pull people up. You know, I can't say it was a woman that did it for me. It was Delegate Frank Turner, but he knew that I was passionate about that. But we just have to be intentional. And I agree 100%. You know, we have a brand new African-American female chief of police in Howard County. And I think it is so amazing because, and I told her this, you know, little girls will see you and they will see that they could do this if they wanted to. And so, you know, I think we just have to help women, black women, get into those pipelines.
So the criticism you often hear with that sort of reasoning is that we shouldn't matter what sort of the color of the candidate is, if they're female or they're male, the best should be the only factor that makes a difference, right? That's the only reason you should vote for the person. So, but any thoughts specifically about your experience as an African-American woman in the legislature, that if you weren't there, present, that issue wouldn't have been discussed in the way it was discussed, or this different nuance of the bill wouldn't have been brought to the table?
So, just to backtrack really quickly, so Delegate Frank Turner was first elected, I think, in 94, first African-American elected to statewide office from Howard County. In 2014, Delegate Terry Hill, who represents District 12, Baltimore County, and Howard County, and I were the only first two females, black females, elected. That was 2014. So, you know, that's a long, and interestingly enough, this is just a little side note, when I meet people, and they shall remain nameless, I mean, people in elected office, they just assume I'm from Prince George's. You know, they just ask me, how are things going in Prince George's? And I'm like, no, I actually live in Howard County. So, you know, we all bring our different experiences to the table when we're in Annapolis, which is one of the things that is fascinating and frustrating about it. And so for the first 4 years, I served on the Judiciary Committee, and then the Speaker appointed me Vice Chair, so I'm still on the Judiciary Committee, and I love the committee. I think it is the most important committee in the House. But when we are debating issues, the fact that I'm a mother, the fact that I'm female, and the fact that I'm African-American all come into play. Your values come into play on how you interpret laws that affect children, marijuana regulation laws. I mean, just all these things, they do. Healthcare affect your decisions.
Okay. So just we'll take this national for just a second. Okay. So I'm sure you've heard what's been going on in Virginia, and I can't help but notice that all these political scandals are always when it's a man in public office. Rarely do these things happen to women. Do you have any sort of thoughts on the situation, what's been going on with the governor and now the lieutenant governor in Virginia?
So it's just all very disgraceful all around. It's just disturbing and it's disgraceful. So, you know, in terms of the blackface, I went to William & Mary, and I guess being a naive young adult coming from Howard County, that was the first time I heard people use the N-word and all types of other racial epithets. So is it shocking that the governor posed in blackface? Absolutely. But as I, over the past couple days, have sat and thought about my experiences in Virginia, I'm not surprised. And quite frankly, probably, you know, every yearbook throughout the state has some sort of blackface in it during those time periods. My first experience going to William & Mary, we were going to move in, and the newspaper, whatever it was called, had a cartoon on it called The Mighty Whitey, with some kind of character in a cape, a black character, with fried chicken and watermelon. And I looked at my parents and I was like, is this where I'm going to school? You know. So I think that type of thing is, I mean, it's the South, pervasive in the South. But you would hope that the folks that have run for public office would not have done that or would be forthright and honest about it. Okay? Because backtracking and lying is a whole different story. You know, any accusation of rape or sexual assault should be taken seriously. And, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And anyone who is accused of that by one person or multiple people, I mean, you just have to take stock of whether or not they should really be in office. And they should probably, for the benefit of the state, step down.
Okay. Well, on that really depressing note, I'm gonna turn it over to Luke.
Yes. So, Delegate Atterbury, you, as you mentioned, are now the vice chair of House Judiciary, which I think is perhaps the most important committee in the General Assembly, or at least in the House. Appropriations might argue with that, but but you're in charge of all the criminal justice and law enforcement bills. And for many years, Chairman Valerio was seen, maybe fairly, maybe unfairly, as somebody who blocked a lot of the bills coming through. What do you see? What do you hope to accomplish this session in this new role?
So I am excited. I was very surprised to be appointed vice chair. I'm excited to work with Chair Clippinger. And, you know, we have put new systems into place. We've got new subcommittees. We've got working subcommittees that the bills, some of the bills will go through that need to be worked on, and we'll make recommendations to the committee. My goal is to just work with Chair Clippinger and give it a fresh face, for lack of a better word. You know, there's a lot of excitement from the 13 new members that we do have that are there. And so I do think there probably will be a swell of bills that have met the drawer in the past while Chair Valerio was there. So we'll see some repeat issues, but we'll also see a lot of new issues and a lot of folks, I think, who may have tried to get things done in the past but had gotten stymied, I think are going to try again.
And for the uninitiated, Chairman Valerio was a long tenured figure. He was mm-hmm. defense attorney and had a different perspective on things. Delegate Clippinger, who's now the chair, is a prosecutor, and now you're the vice chair. So that's maybe a little change in direction for the committee.
Yes, maybe. We'll see. We'll see.
And one bill you're sponsoring, which has been in the news and will probably be very controversial, is the long guns, background checks for long guns.
Totally not controversial. Totally, we should just pass it. That's it.
So make the pitch. Why is this the year to pass background checks for long guns?
If you've sat in the committee or you've been on the House floor and you heard me talk, I didn't speak that often, but when I do, it is to protect children, women and families, children in particular. That has always been my goal, but particularly since I've had kids, that's really come to the forefront. Mass shootings, whether it's at a school or at a mall or at a movie theater, families should not have to deal with that when they go out, and that is something that I worry about. Unfortunately, that's something we saw right here at the Capitol Gazette, and that was a shotgun. I think the ones that get all over the news are the AR-15s and that type of thing. But shotguns are used too. So why not take the robust, very safe system that we have in place already for handguns and apply that to long guns? No one's saying you cannot get your long gun. We're just saying, hey, get your permit first, get your background done first, and then go buy your long gun. One of the fears that I have, and this may sound just off base, but everything we hear in judiciary, I have a lot of worries. But one of the main ones is a shooting happening at my kid's school. You know, now I get these emails and text updates that, oh, we had a great shelter-in-place drill. Well, they shouldn't have to be doing shelter-in-place drills. I took my kids to see the Lego Movie 2, which just came out.
So, as did I this weekend.
Did you? Yes. Okay, so everything is awesome. Right.
Yeah.
So if we went to see that, I'm literally looking at the exits to see if something happened, what am I going to do with my kids? Because I was by myself. They go to Cartoon Cuts in the mall. I don't like going to the mall. I'm like, what if something happens in the mall, which it did at one point in Columbia. So we shouldn't have to think about that. I think, you know, the argument is going to be made and valid to some that, you know, you're making things more laborious, you're putting more requirements on us and more restrictions. No, it's the same requirements in terms of having to get a handgun, and we're just trying to keep Maryland safe and protect families. That's it.
Now, the other side says, well, maybe we can see background checks on handguns, but long guns are for hunters. You know, why would you disrupt the good old-fashioned trade of hunting? What do you have to say to that?
Well, if all you're going to do is hunt with your gun and that's all you've been doing with your long gun, then fine. You take the background check and you have absolutely nothing to worry about. We're trying to catch those outliers who, you know, might have something in their background, and we can prevent something horrible happening. So that's where my head is at this. And I guess that goes to the earlier question when we talk about different perspectives in the legislature. You know, I think my perspective is safety for all of our citizens. You can get your gun, just get your permit first.
And what else, what other are your main bills you're pushing this year?
So I have been trying to change the age of marriage for several years now. I think this might be the fourth year. And I was very happy until I saw one of the main opponents is now in JPR. It's gotten close. Right now you can get married at 15 if you have had a child or a doctor says you've had a child, or 16 and your parents' consent, I'm sorry, or if you're 16 or 17, you have one or the other. We found that in Maryland there are, in the past 10 years, about 3,000 or so girls, teen girls, who are marrying men 10 years and older. This is not a romanticized teen-on-teen love thing that some people think about. I had a young woman who testified. She was from Maryland. She was 17. Her mother started selling her body when she was 13 to other men. And then when she was 17, took her to the courthouse, signed off, and married her off. And she lived 10 years in a horrible situation of abuse. And so what I would say to the opponents, who their main argument is, mind you, it's not religious, ironically. There's been no, the Archdiocese of Baltimore is supportive. No other religious organizations have come out to oppose the bill. Unfortunately, NARAL and the Women's Law Center in the recent years have opposed it, saying that they believe if we start regulating marriage, we're going to regulate choice. This is Maryland. We are not going to regulate choice. As a matter of fact, Speaker Bush has a bill to put on the referendum to just codify a woman's right to choose. We're not going to do that in Maryland. So I hope they would get on board this argument of the best way to save yourself as a woman is, you know, to get married and hitch yourself to a man or a partner and, you know, your life will be great. No, we know your health will go down. You won't finish your education. You'll probably get divorced. And your kids will live in the same cycle of poverty. So I'm trying to make this happen.
And your bill would raise it to what?
18.
So 18. From 15 to 18.
15 to 18. 1 year I got it passed out of the House in 18, died. The Senate just seems to think 15 is okay. Last year I made a compromise and I said 17, and then it still died because on Sinai died, the Senate thought 16 was still, you know, nice to get married. I have the bright line 18, which Chairman Zirkin has cross-filed. And then I also, and we just had a great hearing, but, you know, there's still some concerns. And I have an emancipation statute, which says if you're 16 or 17 and you get emancipated and a judge finds all of these things, then perhaps you can get married.
And then, you know, it's your second term, mm-hmm. right? You're already a vice chair of a very important committee. A lot of people see you as someone rising up the ranks quickly. What do you want to do next?
You know, I like to keep those things to myself.
Okay. You don't want to break any news right here?
Yeah. I don't want to break any news right here.
Okay. That's fine.
But I always do have a plan in my head of where I want to go and what I want to do. The first time I ran for office, quick funny story, I took my family, before I had kids and everything, I took my family and went out to dinner at Philomena's in D.C. And I said, hey, in 6 months I'm going to run for office. Oh, yeah, okay. And then 6 months came and I said, okay, we're running for office. You know, so I do – I always think about things that I want to do. I love Maryland. I love living here. I love that I'm raising my kids here. It's a great place to be, and I do want to continue to just make this a great place for everyone to live.
Vanessa Atterbury, thanks so much for coming on, Delegate.
Thank you.
Normally, I try to end each podcast with some sort of state government pun that Luke tolerates. But instead of that, this week, I want to extend best wishes to Senator William C. Smith, Jr. He'll be deploying to Afghanistan for Operation Resolute Support on March 29th. Thank you for your service to Maryland and the country, Senator.
Yes, I know the whole of Annapolis and the whole of Maryland, regardless of party, will be thinking of Senator Smith during his deployment. Thanks for listening, everyone. And a special thank you to producer Steve Early and Hallie Miller. You guys are the best. While times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please subscribe to the Baltimore Sun at www.baltimoresun.com. Thanks, and see you next week.